Welcome to the Evoking History Podcast.
We are called as a people to give testimony in the sight of the world to our faith that the future shall belong to the free. Since this century's beginning, a time of tempest has seemed to come upon the continents of the earth. Masses of Asia have awakened to strike off shackles of the past. Great nations of Europe have fought their bloodiest wars. Thrones have toppled, and their vast empires have disappeared. New nations have been born. For our own country, it has been a time of recurring trial. We have grown in power and in responsibility.
Hello and welcome back to the Evoking History Podcast. Today, it is my distinct pleasure to be joined by Associate Professor of Political Science here at Marquette University, Noah Brigden. How are you doing, Dr. Brigden?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
I'm good. Once again, I want to thank you for taking the time out on your Saturday to speak with me. If you don't mind, if you could tell my listeners just a little bit about yourself, where you got your degree, and what it is that you study.
Yes, so I got my PhD in the Department of Government at Cornell University. And I study international relations and human security. More specifically, I've done research on borders, on political and criminal violence, on transnational migration, increasingly on gender and bodies.
Thank you. And I think that's really fascinating. What first drew you to those particular subfields?
Yeah, so I guess every research story starts with a sort of personal story. I grew up in Southern California, so it has always been really clear to me that issues related to the border and undocumented migration were essential to understand from a human rights perspective. And I think growing up in Southern California gives you an appreciation of how unnatural and imposed borders really are on communities and individuals. And not just because you're growing up right next to the Mexico-US border, because California itself is a sort of transient society. It's the gateway to the Pacific. People come there from all over the country, including my own parents from different regions in the United States. And you have a real sense growing up in that environment that movement is something natural, is part of the expression of your own individual agency. And so I think it was always clear to me that the borders were something sort of imposed, and I was always sort of puzzled by the fact that people took them for granted in politics. Now, from there, I ended up enlisting in the military at 17, and I got shuttled all around the globe on my own sort of transnational adventure. And what really shocked me when I was in the military was I got off the plane in Korea and went off to this military base near the DMZ. And outside of the military base, I found Tijuana. And the parallels between the political economy, the local political economy around the military bases that I was stationed at, and then the border towns were striking to me. So you had the same kind of saloons and brothels, cheap knockoff goods and terrible trinkets for tourists that are very cheap to sell. And the types of relationships that formed between people who could go to and from the military base to the community and those who could cross back and forth across the international borders were very similar positions of privilege in a lot of ways. And this, of course, gives birth to all sorts of gray markets and black markets. And I got a real sense that I was watching power at the margins and how it functions. That if I wanted to understand American power, I had to go to these places in the global political economy that seemed to be where the seams were showing. And so I found this really interesting. And when I got back into university after my time in the military, and I took a Spanish class about Latin American politics, which just sort of threw the windows of the world open to me. And I became very passionate both about doing research on politics, but also becoming a teacher. And I went to go do a PhD in international relations, thinking I was going to study these global political inequalities. And I was shocked that in the field of political science, everything was top down.
Yeah.
And if there was one thing I had learned in my time in the service, it was that the view from the top doesn't look the same from the bottom. And I began to smuggle in methods from anthropology into political science to be able to try to bring that into communication with that discipline. And so I've become a sort of disciplinary border crosser as well in that process. So that's kind of, I guess, the long way to explain how I ended up studying borders and violence. And then, of course, my more recent work now that is just beginning a nascent shift to understanding gender and bodies and the gendered social imagination grows out of that. I mean, conceptually, I've always been very interested in how everyday material practice, kind of embodied politics, shapes the social imagination. And then that in turn influences the opportunities and patterns of global politics, whether it's the future of the nation state under conditions of globalization being shaped by the footsteps of migrants over time. Or now I'm very interested in how very simple athletic practice even, or strength training can challenge gendered notions of the body and strength, and how that might also have a role in shaping larger political patterns and opportunities for people. So personally, it grows out of this interest in bodies, grows out of the experience of doing field work along the transnational migration route from El Salvador through Mexico and into the US. And I spent a couple years of pretty grueling field work doing that. And by the time I got home from living out of the Catholic shelters along the migration route and so forth, I had dropped a lot of weight and I came back pregnant as well. And then I had a very short period of time to finish the dissertation and go on the job market and do all of these things and teach. And physically, I was very beat up, and I have metal rods that run up and down my spine from a spinal injury when I was 20. And that was taking a toll. I got to the point where I wasn't able to carry my books across campus, for example. And so when I got to the postdoc phase, and I was still shell-shocked from this experience of studying violence, physically, emotionally, I made a rule that if I sat at my computer more than 10 minutes or 15 minutes or what have you, and just sat there blankly in shock, I would get up and move, and I would go to the gym. And, you know, a lot of the horrific stories I collected about the violence that Central American refugees and asylum seekers experience en route to the United States, they all seemed quite normal during my field work. And when I had gotten back and was in that posh office at Brown University on a postdoc, I would look at my own words and my notes about my experiences and what I was listening to and just kind of wonder, how could I have possibly gotten this right? And so when I would go to the gym with all of this sort of floating around, unsure about how to do it justice when I looked at my computer and wanted to convey it to other people, I would go to the gym and it became a ritual for recentering myself, recentering my own identity on my strength. You know, I'm a military veteran. I'm a mother. I am a survivor, and I can do this. And so being able to then incorporate that type of messaging into a physical practice for me was recentering and empowering in this very profound way. And that year on my postdoc, I didn't finish, you know, reshaping that raw dissertation into a book manuscript, but I did get into really good shape. And I ultimately picked up a very obscure hobby called powerlifting, where the goal of lifting weight in the gym is not what you look like, but to be the strongest person on the platform. Mm-hmm. And I began competing in those strength competitions. And I think this is very subversive for many women to participate in, because we tend to value women's bodies as a source of beauty as opposed to a source of strength. And to be able to value your own body for what it can do rather than what you see in the mirror can be really radical to those of us who've been socialized into feminine roles. And so this really became part of who I am. And when I returned to El Salvador to do a next project, which looks at the borders between street gangs and how people imagine those borders and how that impacts citizenship, people began to react differently to me because my posture had changed, my body had changed, I'd put on muscle weight. And on the one hand, I found it difficult to relate to people the way I used to as a young mother, as a Catholic shelter volunteer and so forth. And I began to look for new ways I could contribute to the community and carve out a space for myself that was reciprocal in the communities where I do this research on violence. And people began to ask me for fitness advice. And not just women, but men were asking me. And I was able to engage men on equal footing in this sort of transnational society of the bro. Like, we spoke the same language, we shared some of the same goals. And I could speak to them in a way that wasn't sexualized, that when I was younger and didn't have this particular hobby was really difficult to do. And I started to wonder what that did to gender as I was building these relationships. I view my own field work as transformative, not only of myself, obviously, but also the relationships I build with people are just as important to me as the research that I produce in terms of how I believe I affect social transformation around me. And the relationships I began to build through this lifting hobby were more egalitarian because they were based on something sincere I do for myself, not just because it's the right thing to do. And I began to wonder if that could change community, if that projects a different way of imagining the female body that could challenge or subvert some of the norms that constrain us, both men and women. It's not just about women. And so I began to teach powerlifting classes. First, they started as calisthenics classes because we didn't have the equipment. Mm-hmm. And then I broadened it to powerlifting classes once I was able to get equipment to one of the communities. Initially, I had in mind that I would work with women, but the men really wanted the classes. And they pointed out that, in fact, in one of the communities where I was working, it was the men that faced greater risk trying to get to the gym because it was near the borders between street gangs and they were facing such severe police harassment in this marginalized urban community that they were actually more constrained in some ways for their fitness opportunities. And so it became clear to me that this had to be a sort of gender empowerment program for both men and women because gender is creating vulnerabilities for all of us in different ways and patterned differently. And I also began to realize that if the men could respect me as an authority on how to reshape their body and work with me, and as long as I can still beat them in a pull-up contest, that I thought this was actually a wonderful opportunity, not only to reward women for assertiveness and recenter our own identities and our strength, but to also encourage others to respect that assertiveness. And so we developed a program where men and women could train together. We also have separate classes now. And this sort of grew. And this is a nascent program. I don't want to overstate how far we've come yet. But the idea now is to develop a sort of gender empowerment program that can also promote healing from trauma for individuals as well as community in a sort of collective sense around the practice of strength sport in El Salvador, and to have this be research informed. So putting together a team at this point to be able to carry out research on the impact of the gym and the gendered imagination of strength and how it shifts over time, and whether or not this social space can actually change community boundaries, potentially increasing inclusion, whether the program could address public health concerns like diabetes without relying on fat shaming and body shaming that are traditional aspects of fitness, but not so much in the powerlifting world. Whether or not ultimately, for me, what I'm truly interested in is whether or not we can understand very basic daily strength practices as a form of resistance to structural violence. And so that's how this idea was born. It's now called Pesas y Poder, which means weights and power, powerlifting para el pueblo, powerlifting for the people.
Well, I definitely do want to talk about that. We've talked about that program before off air, and so I definitely do want to talk about that. But I have some other questions. When you, and I'll start with this, when you mentioned doing field work, that really stuck out to me, because I don't think of field work as necessarily part of the of political science. And that could be my own misunderstanding of the discipline, being as that I'm a historian. But when I envision it in a similar way into doing field work as to what we do, being very archival, or like you said, very top down, in libraries or other data collections and stuff like that, not necessarily that aspect of anthropology, which I do necessarily think of when I think of field work. So did you get any pushback for incorporating that into your dissertation and your degree?
Yeah, so I do think field work is common in comparative politics, in particular in political science. But most of that field work is qualitative, but not necessarily ethnographic. And I think there's a really big difference between qualitative field work, which is wonderful and important, and ethnographic field work. Much of the field work in political science tends to be start with some sort of deductive hypothesis testing and process tracing and so forth. Now, in the actual process, the best people in political science absolutely go out and use inductive methods to identify research questions that are relevant and important. And they allow the information coming to them through immersion to reshape what they're doing. I think there are some, nevertheless, different sorts of methodological commitments that come with embracing the ethnographic methodology from the get-go as a sort of inductive means to have embodied research that systematically imagines what life is like for other people by living among them in during participant observation. So I do think that there are some, that type of field work in particular is not necessarily part of the mainstream of political science. And as I was pitching it, I did get a lot of pushback from people that wanted me to frame the study much more deductively. And I was able to do that, I think, to some degree, to incorporate some very systematic thinking about likely findings I could come across, and found it really helpful to be pushed. Yeah. By sort of positivist methodologists in political science to always sort of justify and make systematic some of my starting assumptions or my expectations. I don't use the word hypothesis because I don't think it's appropriate for the type of research I do, but I certainly had to form very clear expectations based on the literature about what I expected to find by going into the field. So in that sense, no, ethnography is rare in political science. And I think that the amount of field work that I did for my research was also rare. And people would say things to me like, what if you do all that field work and you don't end up getting a job? And I tried to explain to people that actually I was doing the PhD to justify doing the field work, right, rather than doing the field work in order to get the PhD. I mean, for me, really, the field work is also very much an end in itself. In that I do think the relationships I'm able to build transnationally as somebody who works in the field are just as important as my research. And I think that position towards my research ethics might also be something less common in political science, certainly not absent. One quick thing though, the department at Marquette in particular has really rich, wonderful field workers who, even if they don't do ethnography, are so committed to the communities that they serve. I mean, we have Brian working in Mexico with social justice issues and workers, and Jessica working in the HIV movement, social movements, and so forth, that I definitely don't want to give the impression that I am like the lone political scientist out there doing this kind of social justice, really worthy kind of work. I want to make sure that, like, I spread the love to all my colleagues at Marquette. I think Marquette has a really unique poli-sci department with the rich diversity of both qualitative and quantitative approaches to issues that are sort of fundamentally social justice issues that should be at the forefront of all these discussions.
I fully support that. I mean, I don't interact with your department a whole lot, but the people that I have interacted with, I think very highly of.
Absolutely. And I do too. So I just want to make sure that I'm clear that poli-sci does have that field work tradition, even though I do it from a peculiarly anthropological and political geography, critical geography kind of position, it's certainly, there's shared commitments to social justice, especially among the people I work closely with, so.
I'm glad you made that correction, because I didn't want to make it sound like that either. I was thinking more of poli-sci in general as opposed to our institution specifically.
Yeah, and I think poli-sci in general tends to be pretty top-down. International relations in particular as a subfield of poli-sci tends to take as their work issues that happen in the halls of power rather than in the everyday lives of global citizens. So yeah, I understood what you were getting at. I just wanted to make sure.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I actually want to commend you for that, because I think that, and I see this sometimes in my own field as well, that a lot of times we study communities without getting to know them or doing anything for them and are just kind of ethnographic voyeurs, and you have completely rejected that. So, and that's inspiring in a lot of ways.
It is a work in progress. So,
sure.
You know, I'm still working on rejecting that, I think would be my disclaimer.
Of course, of course. What drew you to El Salvador specifically?
So this was, there's always the short answer and the long answer to that. In retrospect, it makes a lot of sense. I grew up in Southern California in the 80s at a time when a lot of the people I saw on the street as a child, I didn't realize where they had come from, Central America, or why. At that time, and to end up then back in El Salvador and circle around, in some weird way, it just makes sense to me. In a practical way, and a much shorter answer, is that initially I was going to study patterns of collective remittances. And I wanted to understand if the insurgency in El Salvador had left a sort of social residue of resistance,
right,
that could actually be mapped onto the terrain, looking at patterns of collective remittance behavior. So where people would send money back from the U.S. to buy a community ambulance rather than Nikes for their kid, for example.
Sure, yeah.
Now, I got to El Salvador to do my preliminary research, and collective remittances were not a thing. Like, it was not relevant.
Okay. But
people started telling me these harrowing stories of the journey itself. And these were impassioned stories. And it was very clear to me that that was relevant. And that was a story that I wasn't hearing in political science that seems to take for granted the viewpoint of destination countries or intended destination countries and assume that people get from point A to point B, when in fact, that long journey, and it's increasingly long and treacherous as a result of this tightening global border regime all across the world, is itself politically really consequential, not only to the individuals and their sense of belonging and experience and life chances, but also to the societies through which they pass, from which they leave, to where they arrive, that this has much broader, larger implications that I thought had not been unpacked. So that was sort of, I started out going to El Salvador in part because of the history of migration and insurgency and resistance and looking for kind of residual elements of resistance there, and then finding, kind of stumbling across the experience of the journey.
That experience of the journey, is that something that you said earlier made me think this, and if I'm incorrect, please clarify, but it made it sound like not only did you study the journey, but you made the journey yourself and kind of did field research at various stops along the way.
Yeah. So I did not make the journey myself.
Okay.
So, and even if I had, it could never be something that I think anyone should dare compare.
Oh, no. Yeah.
We'll do, you know, like that. In fact, there was one segment of the route I was going to walk with migrants in a very particularly treacherous part of the terrain. And they asked me, they stopped me and said, what do you expect to learn from this? And I took a moment and I said, well, I don't know. Maybe I don't know, but maybe it would be worth doing. And they said, you know, you'll never experience what we experience. And at this time, I'd already been back in the U.S. and this was a return trip.
Sure.
Back. And so I was already really fit at that point coming back. And they said, look at you. You're nourished. You know, look at me. I've been malnourished. I haven't had enough to eat. You know, they could show me scars from the mistreatment they had suffered or the violence before they left home, even. And they said, really, no matter what you do, you walk alongside of us. And this is not, you know, you're not going to learn what it's like. And so that gave me pause. And I didn't accompany them for that segment of the route, actually, as a result. So no, I absolutely did not do the journey with them. I did follow the route working out of, I started at a midway point at a Catholic shelter and worked there for many months to sort of understand the lay of the land. This was after a year in El Salvador. So wait, let me start over. So first I did a year in El Salvador where I did a paired comparison of the human smuggling markets in two rural communities. So I started there and I got a really good sense of what was going on from that vantage point. From there, I made a contact that got me a volunteer position at a Catholic shelter at a midway point across Mexico. I then went to that shelter and worked there for about 6 months or so, so that I would get the lay of the land. I had some reputation. People knew who I was along the route. I had some credential that I wasn't just in and out, that I had been working in the shelter for some time. And from there, then I made targeted trips along the corridor, including up into the United States, because these routes don't stop at the US border.
No.
At the time of my research, it cost just as much to get from McAllen to Houston as it cost to get from Mexico to McAllen. So to give you a sense of the internal policing, you know, Los Angeles is a hub then for distribution to destinations and so forth as well. So I did accompany migrants for a train ride on top of the freight train in a southern segment of the route. So there, I did do some accompaniment, but I don't like to give the impression that I did the journey myself, just because I think that that isn't, I just don't think that's fair to phrase it quite that way.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm curious, and I'm curious about a lot of things, honestly. This has been a fascinating talk so far, and we're just barely begun. I'm curious, because a lot of Americans, and I will count myself amongst those at various times in my life, don't really understand exactly what is going on and conceptualize that people are going through multiple countries, especially if they're coming from Central America. And we, you know, the popular Fox News spin on this is that these are all Mexican immigrants and the vitriol and complete distortion of things around that, which is makes it even worse than when we have stuff like just happened recently. I think it was yesterday when it was announced formally that we were deporting people from Central America just back into Mexico. I have several very bad thoughts about that. Yeah, exactly. What are some of the, but this is a gray economy, as you mentioned, much like what springs up around military bases or other things. And that always makes me think of the forced projection of colonialism and all this and the disruptive markets and national identities and everything that spring up around that. But what in your studies and have you found out, you say that they meet a broker who helps them get out of El Salvador, is that, are they then transitioned to someone in Mexico or is it the same person the entire way through?
Yeah, so that's a really big question. There's a lot of different ways to travel. There's many, many different travel packages. There's many different travel plans. There are people that just leave their house only knowing I'm going to put one foot in front of the other and somehow I will survive and get there. So there's a lot of variation. There's door-to-door smuggling packages that are much higher priced that you can pay for. You know, you pay a certain amount at the outset and a certain amount upon delivery, but that doesn't mean that you're being moved by the same person all the time. And in fact, we've seen there's a lot of variation in how these are organized. These are not monolithic kinds of operations. They're very fluid, very dynamic as far as how they're networked. And I think it's really important not to conflate the human smugglers with the cartels. Now, the cartels are the criminal terrain bosses of Mexico. They do sometimes smuggle people and drugs, but oftentimes what they're doing is charging a passage fee for the territory that they control for the human smugglers to cross across it. And so the human smugglers and the cartels have oftentimes a very contentious relationship, actually. And you see that in the birth of this kidnapping business that took place when the drug war began to escalate again after 2005. There's a lot of different ways that this works. One way is that you contract with someone in your local town, and he then subcontracts or has a network that comes together so that, you know, they'll all converge on the capital city in San Salvador from different parts of the country. And then from there, they'll go to Guatemala. They'll change hands in Guatemala and be moved by different segments of this sort of outsourced network north. But there are other models now that are even more diffuse and more difficult to hold accountable for what happens to people once they leave home. And people are very aware of that. So rather than subcontracting out, sometimes they'll sell you. So you get as far as the border. So you get as far as the border with Guatemala, and you're worth very little money to anybody at that point. Because the ultimate payment for you, that $5,000 on delivery or $6,000 on delivery, happens in Houston. And so you're worth very little because the odds of you getting there are actually pretty low.
Right.
And so they'll sell you to somebody who then takes you, and now you get to Mexico City, and then you're a little bit closer to that final payment. So you are closer in value that you're worth on delivery. So they might sell you for a little bit more money. And the closer you get to do your delivery, the closer your value as a package is to that delivery value. Now, if your value looks like it would be better attained by selling you to a different kind of trafficker, whether that is a sex trafficker or a labor trafficker, or somebody that holds you hostage to try to renegotiate that contract for delivery so that they can get more money out of your family members, then you're going to be sold into that other network. You're not going to be delivered as you had imagined you would be. And you're essentially at that point out of the hands of the people that you had initially contracted with.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of variation to this, and there it does hit a point where people are kidnapped and there's no intent to deliver these people whatsoever. They'll just torture them on the phone with their relatives in New York until they pay the money simply to have them released into the hands of local immigration authorities in Mexico, who then deport them back to start over. Ever more desperate then to get to the US to pay off the debts that their family members have already sunk into their arrival, so that they can actually work and pay off those debts. And so then they'll take even more risks to get there the second time, knowing that they've already accrued that kind of debt for their family. So there's a lot of variation, and you can see that the way that this interfaces with trafficking networks or kidnapping networks is really fluid. Yeah. Terrain changes hands really quickly among these criminal terrain bosses. And when it does change hands, a smuggler who you thought was trustworthy, A, he might get killed himself, you know, because he didn't pay the right person to cross the terrain, or now is dealing with a competing group, or B, he might defect and to save his skin and actually sell you on to people that are much less savory. So it's hard to kind of generalize about how people get there. In general, they do have packages for the door-to-door delivery that are rather high-end, very expensive packages. And then the vast majority of the people who get to the Catholic shelters either have had something go tragically wrong in one of those arrangements, mm-hmm. or they never have. And they are, you know, they either had to flee before they had the appropriate time to save the money that it would cost to get there safely, or they don't have the networks in the United States that some of the others do to help raise the funds or the support. And so the ones traveling very visibly on the freight train are oftentimes the poorest and most vulnerable. And the fact that they're visible is sort of, that says that in a yeah. place where invisibility is your survival strategy.
Man, that is both heartbreaking and fascinating. I've had an opportunity to talk with some refugees before, and both some people who came in from Mexico and then some from Iran, who their tales of getting into Europe sound very similar to this. I remember one of them telling me that her and her family were coming out, and she was just a young child, and the group that was smuggling them out they ran across a warlord, and they thought that there was going to be a gunfight. People were getting out their AKs and everything else, but then they just found out that somebody in the warlord band was a cousin of one of the people smuggling them, so it pacified the situation to where they can get through. And I think that that is, again, something that people just don't understand, the what would drive people to take these incredibly risky and dangerous journeys.
Absolutely. And I think it's also important to remember that right now the numbers of people from even outside of Central America trying to cross through Mexico are quite high too. So there is overlap with what's happening there. But yeah, I mean, initially when I started doing my field work in 2008 on my first trip to El Salvador, and I asked people why they were leaving Central America, they would say, I'm going to build a better life for my family so that I can work and send money home. But if you kept asking them questions about, well, why don't you have a job? It was because they had to close up the shop because the street gangs were demanding too high of an extortion and they couldn't pay it anymore. So they had to close their small business. Or they'd like to look for work on the other side of the city, but there's a patchwork of terrain of street gangs that they'd have to cross on a daily basis. And that would raise suspicions and potentially they could be killed by crossing back and forth across the different gang territories in their own city. So the labor market itself was very fragmented. And so it was like there was this labor migration story, but similar to the surface, if you ask more than a few questions, was the role of violence at the time. And then around 2012, it began to flip. So that if I asked people why they were leaving, increasingly it became that they mentioned the violence first, that they had been threatened, they had been beaten for their failure to cooperate with the gang. The gang wanted to date one of the daughters, or there was something happening that came first. And if I asked why they were vulnerable to that violence, or if I kept asking questions, I would learn that they couldn't afford to live behind a gate with private security. They couldn't afford to get off their bus route and buy a car. You know, and so the poverty then was still simmering under the surface, playing a role in the vulnerability to violence. And then after that, I started getting increasing reports from people not fleeing the gang, but fleeing the police. So increasingly, I hear stories that are about the extrajudicial violence that people are suffering and being caught between a gang that's threatening them and a police that actually believe them to be part of that gang and being caught in between those two places. And that has become an important part of the narrative, that this isn't a gang crisis that people are fleeing, but a crisis of the legitimacy of the state. And the police themselves are oftentimes viewed as just another gang, not because they have, because they're corrupt necessarily, but because they're preying upon people in a war against their own population in this war on gangs. And yeah. So there are communities that are suffering extraordinary violence from both gangs and sort of extrajudicial violence. I've also seen an increase in the number of cases for people who are claiming asylum on the basis of gender as well. And some of that has to do with the rising consciousness, not an increase in violence, about the fact that they deserve protection. Mm-hmm. So when we look at these caravans of people, I hear some people talk about it as though it's a sign of desperation when you see caravans of Hondurans and Salvadorans and Guatemalans moving north in broad daylight. And I think it's true that we've hit a tipping point, particularly in Honduras, with political repression and street violence that is pushing people out in a mass exodus. But we also see increased consciousness across these countries and in these communities that they deserve, and that the international asylum and refugee regime, it should protect them, even if these increased claims on the basis of violence that is gendered or LGBTQ, or even some of the gang claims. I think it is both a sign of escalating violence, but also a sign of escalating awareness of our rights for protection.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. My next question, I guess, then, is just because of the history of U.S. involvement in Latin America as a whole, thinking back to our support for dictatorships of the 80s and now in the current era, where we have funded a lot of things due to the war on terror. I know that LAPD units have gone down and taught crowd suppression tactics to various police forces in Latin America. Is El Salvador one of these cases?
So El Salvador is very much linked into this sort of what Zilberg calls a transnational security scape. And so, as well as the fact that the militarization of the police in El Salvador has been taking place, in that you see literally the military into these communities alongside of the police. So if you look not only at police cooperation, but in terms of the military support and security support that the United States provides for Honduras and El Salvador, it is extraordinary level of training and support that go into security more broadly there.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So yeah, I think that this the showing the intersection of gender and realizing that the need for protection is really important. And I'm glad to hear that there is that aspect, that awakening, that acknowledgement. And let's transition more into talking about the weightlifting and how you are using that in your current project that you are developing in El Salvador. And you kind of mentioned this briefly, but I would kind of like to go into this more. What drew you to powerlifting specifically? Because there's all kinds of things. You know, the CrossFit, bodybuilding, just all kinds of different athletic things that you could have gone into.
About powerlifting, in comparison to many other windows into fitness, is that the emphasis really is on strength as opposed to aesthetics. So I think that this, for many people, subverts the way they relate to their own body, which tends to be very much focused on image and the mirror, as opposed to what you can do with your body. Rather than choosing bodybuilding, which is focused on aesthetics, and I think it's really important to make that clear because people confuse them.
Yes.
Powerlifting is very much not focused on what you look like, but how much you can lift. And I'm very interested in that. One, I think the movements for powerlifting tend to be more accessible than Olympic weightlifting. So for Olympic weightlifting, you have movements that require a different level of agility and coordination to achieve. I'm not saying powerlifting is easy, quite the contrary, but I do think that it creates more opportunities for access for people that have a variety of different abilities, for example. So in El Salvador, the only powerlifter who's got kind of national fame at this point is a para powerlifter. Mm. Who competes in the Paralympics. And I think that the movements in powerlifting are so basic and simple that we can adapt them to a variety of starting places for people in ways that it would be much more difficult to do with Olympic weightlifting. And then with CrossFit, I really do worry about the extreme sports mentality. You get some of that in powerlifting, but the CrossFit sort of push yourself constantly mentality to me is yet another form of disciplining the body. And what I would like to do for myself and for others is find a space where we go to the gym to reaffirm who we are, as opposed to reshape who we are. It's not about doing, changing and disciplining the body as much as going in and celebrating what you can do with your body already and exercising that, literally. So that for me is how is a nice fit. I think powerlifting, as with any sport, can take you to dark places if you become oriented towards a sort of perfectionism, competitiveness, and so forth. But for me, there are certain checks built into that when I focus on very simple movements of strength as ritual.
That makes sense. And just for people who are unfamiliar with powerlifting, the three main movements in powerlifting are the deadlift, bench press, and squat, which, as Dr. Brigden said, in Olympic weightlifting, where you have to have a whole lot more mobility, especially in your hips and your shoulders, and be able to stand with the weight above your head. So, which if you Google Olympic weightlifting fails, you can see that can have very catastrophic results if you don't know what you're doing or doing it improperly.
Absolutely. And powerlifting can too.
Oh, yes.
But I do think that there's something very adaptable about the movements there. And if one person is really terrible at squatting or has bad knees, there's always the bench press. You know, so that, you know, you have these three different movements, each of them sort of playing to a different body type. And one of the ideas with the programming I'm trying to build in the gym is to create a variety of different metrics through which we can judge our body and find the one that works. For example, I am horrible at the squat. It is sad to watch, but I can bench press like nobody else, you know? And so even down to the movement that you're working on, and some people are agile and some people are flexible and some people are big and some people are small, and just figuring out where our body fits best and rewarding ourselves for that so that we don't have to constantly strive after something that's either unattainable or unsustainable in a long-term way.
I think that that's another great point, because it not only does it allow you to, with the three movements, you can kind of focus in depending on what your physical limitations are. But again, it's that rejection of the aesthetic, because there are quite a few powerlifters who are not aesthetically pleasing in the way that a bodybuilder or a swimmer or something like that is. But man, like, you know, are they suited for their sport because they are incredibly strong? I mean, just some of the numbers that people put up in powerlifting are amazing.
Absolutely. And I think it challenges the way people associate fitness and beauty in a variety of ways, both for men and women, frankly. It's not just about women. And now the gym itself, though, has grown a Zumba class. You know, it is responding to the hobbies and demands of the people there. So it's not just about powerlifting anymore, sure, even though that remains my primary focus. But there's a variety of ways that people can build kind of the expression of their own body in this space. And I'm hoping the community already has taken the reins in many ways of this. Now, currently our gym is closed due to COVID. Mm-hmm. And that was a choice made by the community. They will open it when they feel ready, and there's absolutely no pressure to open it. And that's one of the nice things about having a community gym that's not run by profit motive, is that we can afford to stay closed until it is appropriate for health and safety to do otherwise.
Well, definitely so. So in setting up the gym, can you talk about the process you've undergone in doing that? Because I can imagine that that was a tale in and of its own.
Yeah, so this is actually, it's still at the beginning. I can't stress this enough because I don't want to overstate where we're at. But I found a community where I was working on this issue of gang borders and community borders. And when I was there and started showing up, I noticed that the young men were building their own makeshift weights out of rebar and cement, which isn't particularly safe. And people were asking me for advice about fitness and health. And so I offered to teach these classes that were initially calisthenics classes, because I couldn't get the young men to the gym due to safety reasons. They couldn't travel there in a group. So I started teaching these calisthenic classes in a space that was actually built by a different nonprofit called CIS, the Centro Intercambio y Solidaridad, which is a wonderful group that facilitated the land claim of the squatters that occupy the neighborhood where I'm working in, and made sure that they had decent cement homes, and has worked together with some other groups to get water to this community. And so when they did this project, CIS did, they built a public space for the community. That's where I was giving the calisthenics classes. And I asked the community leadership, they have a group that's in charge of the community of leaders, if they would be interested in establishing a gym there, if I managed. Of course, you know, that there was a tremendous interest because, frankly, more women are dying in the community of diabetes than bullets. And there is a very clear public health concern. And so I managed to do some fundraising with the Marquette powerlifting team, who are wonderful group of co-ed team. And we got our initial pieces of equipment in. And then I won two small grants from the Retired Peace Corps Veterans of Wisconsin. Oh. And so we managed to get the setup for basic powerlifting, as well as a variety of other types of fitness instruments for people of different ability levels. So one of my concerns was making sure that if people weren't comfortable with starting with a barbell, that we had other types of equipment in there that they would find interesting and motivating. And so I went down and began to run our kind of basic classes in powerlifting to teach them how to use the equipment. We certified, I think, about 25 people in the use of the equipment as sort of peer trainers. And then with the second grant we won, we set up a scholarship fund. So we have now sponsored two students to become professionally certified as personal trainers in exchange for them becoming the gym managers. And we hope to extend that scholarship fund each year to have a steady influx of volunteer gym managers with some knowledge in the community about nutrition and fitness and appropriate use of the equipment, who can be caretakers in exchange for these professional certifications, and then try to build for them networks across their own city so that this might actually be viable livelihood opportunity as well. That is where we've started growing to begin with.
Now, you mentioned growing these networks across the city, but how does that then interact with the gang and police borders that have been set up?
Yeah, so that's been difficult. I had to go into the local police and tell them to leave the kids alone. Because for the boys' class at night, they were parking just down the street and waiting so that when the boys would come out, presumably they would have liked to pick them up and harass them or worse. So I had to go in and explain the program and sort of ask that they leave them alone. We haven't had other reports of them sort of stalking our gym at this time, but it does make me nervous to be gone so long without kind of checking. So I will continue. I mean, right now the gym's closed, but that is an issue. We are also concerned for the physical safety of the gym. Thus far, we've had no problems as far as there haven't been accusations of kind of gang activity. It hasn't become a sort of focal point for some of that. And I think that's because in part, the community where we're working has been working with transnational advocacy groups and has been working with American Friends Service Committee on peace building projects and Centro de Intercambio de Solidaridad, CIS, and these other groups for so long that we're building on a foundation of other programs. They have some micro business programs for the women, there's health programming going on. So even though this is a stigmatized part of the city and marginalized, we're also dealing with a very well-organized backbone of community leadership that understands how to harness transnational networks. So these are not people that just, you know, are new to this.
Right,
And this is, I mean, I have all the respect in the world for the fact that these are people that organized their own survival during the Civil War. The community leadership got this community together, and then they survived the earthquake that decimated the homes that they had built after the war. And then they squatted and managed to figure out how to legalize their land claim. So where we're building the gym, the reason why that's possible to maintain, despite it being a conflicted, difficult, violent zone with police brutality and gang issues, has to do with the strength of that community already. So we're building on strengths that exist. And then I think the other part of the question was how we were going to network these kids. So I have increasingly been building my own networks at the gyms across the city in various parts of the city. And what I found was that some of the gym owners in parts of the city that might be considered posh are often surprised that I'm able to come and go to this other part of the city that's stigmatized. And it never occurred to some of them that they could be involved in their own city in some of these spaces. And so I would like to set up opportunities for them that they might not have been aware of to either come and go and visit the gym and build relationships with people there, or potentially hire some of the kids from our program at the end of the day. And I mean, these are not well-paid positions if you work as a personal trainer in a posh part of San Salvador, but nevertheless, the idea of using the gym as a space to subvert borders of all kinds, whether they're international borders or urban fragmentations, we definitely have our eye on doing that in the future.
Oh, that sounds great. It's a fascinating project and one that I could hear you talk about for hours on end. You say that it's rough being away for so long. And that's unfortunately, especially with the terrible way that our government has handled the COVID crisis, there's no way of knowing how long you'll be away. So how are you, aside from being, you know, it sounds like the people there have a great handle on it and don't necessarily need intervention at all times. So what are you focusing on to further the project since you can't be there physically?
So that's how this has become a real project, actually, is, I mean, fieldwork had continued at the pace it was going before with my work on borders and gang borders. Wouldn't have had the time to step back and start getting organized. So I probably would have continued as a show, running the classes when I was there, or, you know, doing odds and ends and building the equipment up with my credit cards and, you know, like those kinds of things that I had been doing. And when I was forced to be grounded for these months, you know, it really occurred to me that I can't be there all the time.
Yeah.
And in fact, I don't know if something could happen in the future and I disappear. And the question of sustainability really became an issue, and how much I value being a part of this project as a person. So during COVID, that's when I have filed the paperwork to make this officially its own nonprofit enterprise in the eyes of the IRS. This is when I have officially contracted with a web designer to set up a page and a bank account and all of these things to try to institutionalize this and set up a board of directors beyond myself, to have a kind of professional group of people to move forward and create a sustainable program as opposed to just me. So you're talking to me at this transition that was actually in some sense enabled by COVID, because it forced me to take a step back and ask questions about sustainability of my own involvement and ethical commitments with the communities that I care about.
That's a good use of COVID downtime. Of course, what I would like to do then, as we are closing up, is I don't know if you have the webpage set up yet or not or anything like that, but I would like to promote that so that if there are people who want to give and support, that they have the opportunity to.
It is not yet set up. We are in the revision process, but it will be set up by Christmas.
Awesome.
So I can send you an update with the link as soon as it's up there, and I would love to promote it. And I will be applying for other kinds of grants and things to support it. So I will send you updates periodically. You won't stop hearing from me.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I've had you on here for an hour now, and that's all I ever ask anybody to sacrifice to speak with me.
So. I appreciate you talking to me. You got me talking about all my favorite things to talk about.
Well, I'm glad to provide that opportunity. Mate, it's been a pleasure. If you have anything social media-wise that you want to promote or anything else, feel free to.
Great. I don't really have anything to promote right now.
Okay.
But it's so good to see you, and stay in touch. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you too and your family, and we will definitely stay in touch because I do want to be involved in this as I can. So
absolutely, I will keep you posted. And as soon as I have the link to the site, I'll share it with you before we release it.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.
And thank you for listening to the Evoking History Podcast.